Carl? Can you hear me, Carl?
I don't think he can, Sonia.
Carl, can you hear me?
Sonia, are we ready to go?
Yes. We're ready to go. Can you hear me, Carl?
Sonia, are you able to hear me?
Yes.
I didn't hear you. Are you able to hear me, Sonia? Nope.
It sounds like he can't hear us, Sonia.
I cannot hear anybody.
Okay.
Carl, can you hear us?
He's shaking his head no.
You can hear me now, Sonia?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry, my bad. Are we ready to go?
Yes.
Okay. All right. If you can hear me, I'm at work. So, Sonia, do I start this or do we just get going? Jackie, are you ready? Anna?
Do you have
go ahead?
Okay. Go ahead, Jackie.
Okay, we'll get started. Good evening, everyone. My name is Jackie Camp. I'm planner, of course, with Clark County Community Planning. And we are here tonight to give you an update on the county's housing option study and action plan project. Some of you that were on the commission in early 2019 may remember, I think it was probably the last PC work session before the pandemic. We presented at a work session to give you kind of the initial scope of the project. We were had done the RFP for the consultants and were in the process of hiring them. It was even before that. It was 2019. So anyway, so you've got a little bit of introduction back then, but we wanted to come back and give you an update on where we are today and kind of keep coming back with you as our project moves forward to keep you engaged in the loop and to hear your feedback and comments as we move forward with the study and action plan. So tonight I have a couple of our consultant team members with us that are going to be presenting along. First is Steve Faust. He's with 3J Consulting, and he's the overall project manager for the consultant team. So we have three firms that are working on this project that each bring kind of a specific expertise to the various components of the project. And then we also have Elizabeth Decker. She's with Jet Planning here tonight to talk with you all. So I'm just going to go ahead and get started. So, and you want to pull up the presentation?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead and go to the next slide. Thank you. So the purpose of the Housing Option Study and Action Plan is to understand our local housing challenges and identify opportunities to encourage creation of additional housing types that are affordable to a variety of households within the unincorporated Vancouver urban growth area. This could be done through the removal of regulatory barriers, so things in codes or our other development regulations, and or implementation of other strategies. The county is focusing, of course, on this area as it is similar to a city. It has just a little bit less population than the city of Vancouver. It's an urban area with urban services where various types of housing like duplexes and triplexes, townhomes, condominiums, multifamily apartments are found compared to outside of the urban areas. So as I mentioned, the county hired a consultant team with experience in assisting local governments with similar housing efforts. In addition, we have an advisory group that was appointed by the county council that's going to assist the staff and our consultants with developing recommendations for consideration by the public, by the planning commission, and by county council. And we have Ron Barca as a representation from the Planning Commission as member of the advisory group. The group represents a broad range of interests, including those most vulnerable to rising housing costs and displacement, people working in the housing industry, parties for responsible for implementing housing-related regulations, and other community organizations, such as our neighborhood groups. We can go on to the next slide, Sonia.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So there are five major phases of the project as it was scoped. The first phase was to help us understand the issues and was included a stakeholder interview process that Steve will summarize here in a minute. But many of you or a few of you were interviewed as part of that process last summer. The second phase is what we're calling the review and analysis phase. So that includes the housing data collection and analysis, as well as the review of our land use policies, code, and regulations. Following that phase, which is where we are currently, will be the recommendation development phase. So right now, the advisory group has heard the information that's going to be presented today. So they've just been kind of information receiving. And then the next phase will be the recommendation development. So they'll start talking about potential strategies or changes that they would like to recommend to provide or encourage the additional housing types in the area based on what they've learned so far. And then there'll be the preparation of the action plan, which will be bringing in all this information and the recommendations as part of a document plan. And then the last phase is the legislative process to move it through the Planning Commission and County Council. As I mentioned, the project is currently in phase two. So we're here to provide you a summary of that work so far. Before the advisory group begins their recommendation development. So before I pass it along over to Steve, is there any questions I can answer so far? Okay, well, I'm not seeing any, so I'll hand it off to Steve.
Thank you, Jackie, and good evening, commissioners. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you about this project. Let's go ahead to the next slide. As Jackie mentioned, the first task that we had was trying to better understand the issues related to housing providing housing for the low and middle income households. And to do that, we conducted a number of stakeholder interviews. Approximately 70, where we were in touch with approximately 70 stakeholders through video and phone interviews, a focus group, and an online questionnaire. And what you see on your screen is the various groups that we were able to connect with. And what Jackie and Jenna asked of us was not to just summarize the themes that we heard the most, but really to identify the full range of issues related to housing within the study area and understand the different perspectives among key stakeholders that represent a variety of expertise on housing. So that was the approach we took to this exercise. Next slide, please. We did ask questions of our stakeholders, of our interviewees, that touched on a variety of themes and documented that these are all documented in our summary report. They include prevalent housing types being constructed in recent years in the study area, zoning in the study area as it relates to development patterns, the supply of land and the characterization of that supply of land, infrastructure needs, the development review process, impact and development fees, design standards and their implications, where needed housing should be located, parking requirements and impacts, affordable housing incentives, the public perception of housing types other than single family detached dwellings, and concerns about displacement that happen around naturally occurring affordable housing. Next slide, please. So again, the summary document itself goes through all of the opinions and ideas that we heard during our interviews. But for the purposes of this meeting, I want to just give a few key takeaway findings or kind of key themes that we heard from folks through this outreach process. So a few of the common themes that we heard and that we'll be considering going forward include, many interviewees commented that the predominant construction of single family detached dwellings does not reflect the entirety of local needs. As the data analysis shows, and you'll see that in a little bit, there are a variety of housing needs across a spectrum of household incomes that cannot be met by single family detached dwellings alone. Stakeholders also note that zoning designations can be restrictive and at times do not allow higher density development along major transportation corridors or near commercial uses. Interviewees said that land availability is one of the most difficult challenges in the county. They say that land is scarce, and where it is available, parcels are not contiguous or are encumbered with environmental constraints. Interviewees feel that there seems to be a disconnect between infrastructure investment and where new housing is expected to develop, and a lag between new development and the infrastructure needed to serve it. And oftentimes they were referring to roads. Several interviewees stated that the review permitting process is perceived as heavily siloed, with a lack of communication between various county departments, causing costly delays. Some stakeholders commented that impact and development fees are high and not scaled to support the development of housing types with smaller footprints. And finally, stakeholders stress the importance of an equitable approach to the regulation of all different housing types. So really taking a comprehensive look and making sure that regulations are consider all different housing types rather than just single family detached homes. Do we have any questions about what we heard from this outreach effort that we conducted last, I think, April through July?
Yes, Steve, this is Aldo. I have a question for you. Is there any particular, any group that you think you may have missed that's not represented?
Great question. I hope not. We started with a great list that county staff developed and kind of built from there. And then the last question we asked in each and every one of our 70 or so interviews was, who else should we be talking to? And that's usually a good way to make sure you haven't missed anyone. So hopefully we've kind of touched all different segments of the community.
When it comes to housing with either low income or down to houselessness, sometimes it actually requires talking to those people in the street. So I don't know if that level of stakeholder was represented in your population that you were working with or not.
No, they were not. I think we can say we had advocates for the houseless, you know, people who work in that area, but we did not do any, especially during, this was in the early days of COVID. A lot of our outreach at that time was virtual because we didn't know even as much as we know now.
Yeah. Great. Thank you, Steve.
You bet. Any other questions about the stakeholder outreach process, or at least this initial phase? Okay. If not, we can move on to our next topic. And Jackie mentioned that there are three firms on our team for this project, and the third one is Eco Northwest. They can't be with us this evening, so I'm going to do my best to give their portion of the presentation. And if you have questions that we can't answer, we'll definitely get back to you with those answers. Yeah. Perfect. Okay, so here are some high-level findings from the Housing Inventory and Analysis Report. Excuse me, this slide shows that the majority, about 76% of the housing stock in our study area, the Vancouver urban growth area, is single-family detached and over 1,500 square feet per unit and on lots larger than 5,000 square feet. The composition of existing housing across the unincorporated Vancouver UGA, when we look at that, the majority of housing is single family detached, followed by the next highest at only 13% is multifamily housing. Excuse me. Overall, our study area has a higher share of single family detached housing than Clark County. Clark County also has a higher share of multifamily and a higher share of attached single family housing. On the right, we see that housing units, a graph that shows housing units by lot size. And it shows that the majority of housing in the study area, as I said, is on are on lots of over 5,000 square feet. So a limited amount of housing, both detached and attached, is built on lots smaller than 5,000 square feet. Let's go ahead to the next slide. Eco Northwest looked at employment growth by industries, excuse me, and also wanted to look at transportation connections between residential options and employment in the region. The graph on the left shows the mode split, or how people commute to work in the study area. The majority of people in both the study area and in Clark County commute by car. The map on the right side shows a 45-minute travel time for an auto trip versus a trip by transit at peak times. So you can see the area that you can reach by car is certainly much greater than the limited area by transit. Next slide. So a key theme with stakeholders and with our advisory group has been changes in affordability or attainability levels of housing across the region, and in specific points in the unincorporated UGA. On the left side, we see a chart that shows median home sales, sales price per lot square foot. This is meant to show that trends in sale prices by square foot and shows changes over time of home affordability. So you can see, we could scroll down just a teeny bit. There we go. The last information pulled from the fourth quarter of 2020 shows that the majority of single family detached housing units in our study area were between $400,000 and $500,000 at home ownership price points. And you can see that those are rapidly rising on the graph there. On the right side, shows changes in asking rent over time, and the average asking rent for a one bedroom is the blue line. And the yellow line is for two bedroom. There's a similar rapid increase in asking price for both one and two bedroom units in the study area. So you can see that home prices and rent levels are both rising rapidly. Next slide. So Eco Northwest looked at the stark differences in wage increases and rent and housing price increases over time. You can see from 2012 to 2019, wages or household incomes in the study area increased by 12%, rents increased by 23%, and average home sales prices per lot square foot, like we showed in the previous graph, increased by 95%. This is happening at a rapidly increasing rate, and more so in Clark County compared to the Portland-Vancouver metro area overall. Next slide. So our team also looked at the income profile and distribution of households in the study area and compared that to Clark County. On the left side, that graph shows us that almost 47% of households in the study area make 120% of the area median income. For reference, the 100% of AMI in the region is about $88,000 per year. There's also a broad distribution of households in the lower income brackets, and especially in the 50 to 80% AMI category in both the study area and in Clark County. On the right side, we're looking at cost burdening, which shows us household income compared to housing prices. A household is considered cost burdened when they pay more than 30% of their income on housing costs. 44% of study area renter households are either cost burdened or severely cost burdened. There's different dynamics at play with home ownership versus renting, but even with that, 23% of homeowners are considered cost burdened or severely cost burdened. Go to the next slide. So here we're looking at household sizes in the study area relative to housing stock. We found that the largest share at close to 60% of households are two-person households in the study area, yet approximately 70% of occupied housing units are three and four bedroom units. We're showing smaller households and larger housing units. This is a trend across the country as people are aging in place and as children leave the home. Let's go ahead to the next slide. This is our last slide. So Echo Northwest forecasted out housing needs by income category. And the basis that they used for that is the comprehensive plan population forecast. So they took the population forecast and applied household size and income categories. And there is a need of a little over 13,000 housing units by 2035 in our study area to meet current and future need. Broken out by income level, about 42% of needed housing is at income levels below 100% of AMI. Current single family detached housing comes in at about 120 to 140% AMI in terms of affordability level. And then rental rates for a two-bedroom unit currently are about 60% of AMI, which gives you a sense of the housing type and tenure and affordability levels. So that concludes some of the high-level takeaways from what is a much more in-depth report on housing data and the analysis of that housing inventory and data. If you have questions, we can try to answer those and/or record them and get back to you with answers if we don't have them readily available. Okay. If we don't have any questions, then I'm going to hand it over to Elizabeth Decker to talk about the regulatory analysis that she conducted. And then after that segment is done, she'll hand it back to me for just a few more slides before we wrap up our presentation. Elizabeth?
Yes, good evening, members of Planning Commission and staff. And thank you all for giving us the chance to update you on where we're at. So if we could look at the next slide here. My role on this project is looking at sort of the regulatory side and how the plans, policies, and development code, as well as other regulations, help shape what the housing options are on the ground, and more importantly, how they could help shape future housing options through some updates through to the code and other regulations. So our first main piece of this to get an understanding of where we are in the county currently is a land use, a policy and regulatory audit. And so the focus here was looking at all of the long range land use plans, you know, all the plans that you all have helped shaped from the county framework plan to the comprehensive plan, other sub area plans, the maps, the land use and zoning maps that helped implement the plans, as well as the UDC, the development regulations, and the unified development code are the biggest pieces that we looked at. We also, you know, were able to supplement that some with some information about, you know, recent permitting trends and impressions from different developers, as well as county, you know, planning staff about what type of development they're seeing on the ground. But our focus for this portion of the work was not focused on, you know, environmental, public improvement, or building code standards, you know, really just because those are more technical issues that often are related to, you know, other county policies, oftentimes with those state policies, as you know, so that can be pretty technical, and we just have less scope to address those. And so even though those are, you know, we want to acknowledge up front that those have, you know, as much, if not more, impact on the price of housing, that we're really focusing our efforts on some of these planning and zoning efforts and strategies that we do have some control over. So the audit, you know, what was interesting about it is that we were really, you know, looking to first describe, be descriptive about what's out there. We wanted to evaluate it in the sense of how do we think this is working? You know, but I want to be clear, it was not, we were not evaluating against a set group of criteria. We were really just sort of generally evaluating against what we see in other similar jurisdictions, how it seems to be working in terms of permitting data. So, you know, it is not something where we could say this zoning code gets a score of 7.8 out of 9. You know, we don't really come down that with such a fine level of detail, because we also wanted to keep it really exploratory in terms of the reason that we're doing this audit is to understand where we're at and where we can go. So we're also exploring and looking for new opportunities in the code to better permit some of the housing types that might meet that, you know, 13,000 needed housing units that we've identified for the Vancouver UGA. Okay, go ahead. And also I'll say, as we were working on the audit, we also were doing a review of recent state legislative changes, as well as some case studies of comparative jurisdictions. And that just gave us a background that helped inform some of that evaluative and exploratory piece. But tonight I want to talk about more of the audit findings. So the first piece that, you know, we are classic planners, we wanted to do this in order. So we started with this community framework plan on the next slide, please. And so this has been county policy since 1993. And the, you know, it's a 50-year vision, overall has a range of housing, transportation, public facility strategies that seem pretty aligned with supporting a range of housing types. But the big finding in the county framework plan that can influence our work going forward is this long-term goal for housing variety, which, you know, you may know, I used to do some work for the city of Ridgefield. So one of the first things I learned about Clark County is that there's this 75-25% goal that every jurisdiction is aiming for, which is to say that no single housing type for new development is supposed to exceed 75% of growth of the new housing units built. And so in most jurisdictions, that's going to be single family detached. And the idea is that the remaining 25% then can be a diversity of different housing units for new development going forward. And so this, you know, the way that this is structured, no single housing type can exceed 75%. It certainly allows for more diversity than the 25%. You know, if in the Vancouver UGA, the zoning and policies that you had in place would support 40% of housing in non-single family detached types, this goal would still be met. So it is not inconsistent, but as a goal and a target, I think that it we want to reflect on what progress we've made and what the future needs might be. You know, as you saw in that eco, that final slide about the housing needs, if we're looking at 42% of needed housing needing to be affordable to households making below 100% AMI, we could probably, you know, this isn't an exact science. Tyler's not here to correct me, but I think that we could, you know, assume that a majority of those units are going to need to be something other than single family detached. So, you know, perhaps there is opportunity or cause to increase the diversity of housing types, at least in the Vancouver UGA, to better meet those future housing needs. So that's something that we can look at. And then next piece, next slide, please. As far as, you know, the plan certainly informs the county's comprehensive plan. And, you know, overall, this is a really strong plan, sets out the implementation of those long range policies for the 2015 to 2035 timeframe. Land use element planning for low, medium, and high residential designations, a range of densities, variety of housing types, really supported by a range of community building strategies around, you know, additional amenities like schools and parks and transportation. So overall, I would say this plan really sets the county up well. Was the result of my analysis for, you know, providing that range of housing types. The only thing that we might need to take a look at as we move forward is going back to these density ranges. If there are some changes in, you know, that we're considering for the UDC and the zoning code, you know, we might need to create some consistency there. But overall, the framework works pretty well. So next piece. We have also, you know, there's a range, as you know, of accompanying plans that are adopted by reference with the comp plan. And so we certainly had a chance to look at, you know, the Healthy Communities Report, the Aging Readiness Plan, found a lot of, you know, exciting tie-ins there of ways that housing options can meet the variety of, or meet the needs of a variety of county stakeholders. But one of the other plans adopted by reference that we thought was important to highlight is this Highway 99 sub-area plan. And so I don't know how many of you were involved in this. It was originally adopted back in 2008. And there are approximately 14 of these sub-areas, or is it 12? But within the Vancouver UGA. So, you know, think about, this is a substantial portion, but it's not the majority of our study area. But it is the one sub area that has had this level of detail of sub area planning. And what it does is it's centered along the, you know, historic Highway 99 corridor, adjacent to I-5 and goes up to the junction with I-205, designates commercial, residential, and mixed use areas. And for our purposes, you know, it creates three different residential designations for multifamily, mixed, and single family. There's a variety of different types of housing that's permitted there. And it is implemented through this hybrid form-based code. And we're still, you know, trying to understand the full full impacts on housing. Our initial review of the code, both through the plan as well as you know, the additional Highway 99 overlay that's adopted in the zoning code, you know, you can see that it adds some additional standards for some of the residential housing options. So things like multifamily, especially mixed use, you know, there's a lot of different form-based elements aiming at both the site and the building design to try to strengthen that and create a more coherent, walkable, you know, engaging community. In other cases, you know, the plan defaults to the existing code. You know, elsewhere. So, you know, a recent change, for example, is that the Highway 99 used to have specific standards for cottage cluster development, but there, you know, were some differences with the cottage cluster standards permitted everywhere else in the county. And so, you know, a recent amendment was to take out the Highway 99 specific cottage standards. And so currently the plan just says, you know, go use the cottage standards that apply everywhere. So, you know, sort of an interesting overlay. And when we look, you know, particularly at these residential areas, it's interesting to try to get a handle on what is the county getting for this additional complexity that it's adding through this plan and through this additional code that's applied in just this portion of the county? Is it really, you know, what we want to get a handle on and what we're working with Jackie and Jenna to get some more data on this is, you know, how is it influencing both the quality of the developments that are coming forward in this area? Are they really mirroring the principles of this plan? Is the form-based code successful in that way? And how's it impacting quantity of development? You know, is it, you know, we certainly heard during some of that stakeholder engagement that it was, you know, some stakeholders felt it was a real hurdle to development. County staff, we've heard that, you know, in some cases it can add to the complexity of the review, but that, you know, people are getting up to speed, they're working through it, getting more familiar with it. So we just want to, you know, on its face, reading through this plan and the form-based options certainly support the variety of housing options we're looking at. But we want to get a better sense of how it influences the development picture in this important area going forward. Okay, next one. Next, you know, so if this is, you know, 12, a small portion of the county, if this is a small portion of the Vancouver UGA, to zoom out, our zoning map findings, when we analyzed the available land across the entire UGA area, study area, there are 3 comprehensive plan designations and they're implemented by 15 different zoning districts. So that's a lot of acronyms to get straight, but I think we've done it. And the major finding, you know, acronyms aside, is that the acre zone for low density zones are the vast majority of both the total land as well as the buildable land in our study area. So you can see that, you know, 89% of the total land is in low density, and of all the buildable land in the study area, 84% of it has a low density comp plan designation. So that means that, you know, that's really where the opportunities are right now as mapped. I think you heard that there are some stakeholder perceptions that there's a scarcity of land. There's certainly, you know, some perceptions that there's a scarcity of medium and higher density land. And, you know, I think that these charts bear that out, or graph pie charts, to say that, you know, there just is a lot more low density land available. And, you know, I'll note that the current distribution of land meets the current 75-25 split for diversity of housing. But, you know, just again, as we're moving forward and we're reevaluating what the county needs are in this particular study area, you know, it's important to note that, you know, we have an awful lot of low density land. There could be some opportunities to, you know, change up the mix, but there's also a lot of opportunity in those low density areas, particularly if we start talking about middle housing or other ways to add more housing options into those low density areas, because that's what we've got. Next. Okay, so when I start talking about middle housing, that really leads into thinking about the variety of housing types that's permitted across the study area. And, you know, frankly, this applies to all the residential zones across the county. But what we wanted to look at is, you know, you've got your traditional single family detached, that's in the leftmost column on this table. Your traditional multifamily, that's on the right. And then in between, you have a range of options, often called, you know, missing middle or middle housing, that's meant to provide slightly smaller units, in some cases much smaller units, but, you know, smaller units relative to a single family detached home at higher densities, and hopefully, you know, slightly lower price points. And so there's a variety of, you know, I think the outcome of the audit is we see that there already are a range of these middle housing types that the county is looking at and incorporating into the code, including the ADUs that I know you've worked on recently. There's some zero lot line options, townhouses have been strong players, duplexes and cottage housing, as well as manufactured home parks. And so we wanted to analyze this range of uses, understand where they're permitted, where they require additional review, and where they're prohibited. So we would generally expect a strong band of green going diagonally across this table, right? So that I should say the zoning districts on the left are organized from least intensive to most intensive. The highest density is at the bottom. And so we'd expect that, you know, the less intense residential uses are permitted in the less intense zoning districts, and the more intense residential uses are in the higher density districts. And that indeed is, you know, more or less what we see here in this table, but certainly some opportunities to, you know, add more green to the table and look for more ways to create more housing, as well as ways to add more columns, additional housing types. Go ahead. So next we want to profile, you know, some of the issues that we saw in those low density areas, which, you know, keep in mind, this is 84% to 89% of the land in the study area. So this is, you know, really where we want to spend a lot of time focusing. Most of the development in those zones is, you know, as you would expect, and as you see in your community, predominantly single family detached. And that's because that's what the zoning allows and really envisions. So it permits, you know, these relatively low densities aligned with, you know, the stated purpose of the zones from 2.1 to 8.7 units per acre. So that's a range of, you know, 20,000 square feet for the largest lots down to 5,000 square feet. But the variety and types of middle housing are somewhat limited in these zones. Even where they are permitted, the lot sizes and the density can make it really difficult to actually develop them. But a promising audit finding is that the lot development standards in terms of the lot coverage and the setbacks, as you see illustrated here, that create the building envelopes, they generally allow, you know, ample building area that, you know, if some of the density and the use restrictions were changed, could really facilitate a range of middle housing types. So there is room on these lots for middle housing. It's just a question of the code permitting them. So go ahead. Let's see. In the medium density zones, you know, what's interesting is the medium density zones are really trying to be everything to every people in some ways, in that because those lot sizes in the low density, you know, are seen to be relatively large and can push up the price of homes, you know, outside the range of the, you know, it pushes it up into that 120 AMI households. And just we're looking at higher priced homes. We do see some interest from developers in building smaller lot, single family detached in the medium density zones. That's certainly a prevailing trend, as well as townhouses here. And that is, you know, again, permitted by the code. There's a greater variety of housing here, but because those two types really are so popular, it gets difficult for any other housing types seemingly to sort of muscle their way through the crowd. There are some issues with the density standards as they're written. They don't necessarily line up with the minimum lot sizes. And so the full development potential maybe isn't being realized. There could be some work there. But again, it's just, you know, the relatively limited land supply here. When you have so many different housing options and so many different types of developers, perhaps that might like to do a project here, can make it difficult to, you know, just it's just a crowded field, I would say. Next. Next, we want to, you know, profile the high density. Oh, take a minute to highlight, you know, as we talked about middle housing, and talked about, you know, the potential here. When we say this is an evaluative audit, certainly what we see is that there could really be some greater opportunities to support middle housing in the zoning code. Right now, the very standard approach to density isn't supporting these different housing types. So, you know, a duplex, triplex, quadplex on a lot, you'd need some changes to density in order to support those throughout some of the low and medium density zones. Definitely do want to, you know, point out the changes that the county has made recently to the ADU and the cottage housing to help expand some options and hopefully make those two more feasible. But there's still some challenges to duplexes and townhouses as they're permitted in the code. And then triplexes, quadplexes, and courtyard apartments. Those could be some smaller projects, you know, say 12 units or less, are not explicitly permitted right now. All those types are just lumped in with multifamily. And if you've seen some of, you know, the typical multifamily development, it's much larger. You're looking at 100 unit plus projects. And so the code that's written really applies better to those 100 plus unit projects. And it makes it pretty difficult to actually build a triplex or a quadplex that meets those same standards. So there could really be some opportunities to pull those out and make the standards more specific to them. So that's what we're seeing in terms of middle housing. Okay, and on the next slide, get to our more traditional high density where we'd be looking to see more multifamily. You know, again, when you think about those AMIs and the number of needed housing units, they're, you know, townhouses, to preview some work that we're doing now, you know, townhouses, duplexes, single family can really only get into the workforce range of housing in terms of housing that's affordable at, you know, say 80 to 120% of AMI. And if we want to be able to address the housing needs of households earning less than 80%, we definitely want to make sure there are some multifamily opportunities. There could be other ways to meet those needs, of course, but this is just, you know, one of the more traditional ways, particularly, you know, if a single site can be developed with, say, 100 units, that can be a pretty impactful contribution to the housing supply. But what we're seeing in the high density zones in the Vancouver UGA is that, you know, first of all, there's extremely limited land supply. The densities of 30 to 43 units per acre that are permitted, you know, that seems to be along the lines of what projects we're seeing come forward. But we don't really know if there's a market for greater density, you know, just because it isn't permitted right now. And in fact, part of the challenge is that, you know, you have this really limited land supply, but some of the proposals coming forward are a lot closer to the minimum densities of 18 to 20 units per acre. So you have a really limited land supply that might not be delivering, you know, the highest density permitted and envisioned in those zones. There can certainly be a conflict on these lands with townhouses being permitted, you know, at those lower densities that do meet the minimum densities on the books, and perhaps provide, you know, it may be more appealing to some developers and some homeowners relative to an apartment project. So definitely some competition here. And also for, you know, developers that are interested in doing a multifamily project, you know, this diagram shows just, you know, a very broad brush trying to show that there are competing demands on the site, and that creates some constraints. The parking at 1.5 spaces per unit and the open space requirements together, those take up more land that eats into, you know, what could be the achievable lot coverage. Technically under the code, you can do 50% lot coverage with the building as illustrated here. But if you did that, you wouldn't have room for parking in open space unless you were able to somehow tuck that parking under. But you know, the economics and the costs of truly undergrounding parking can be cost prohibitive. So that might not be the most promising, but this just helps to highlight why it might be challenging to see densities at that higher range of 30 to 43 units per acre under the current code. So it could be some opportunities there. Next. Okay, and then the last part that we wanted to highlight as opportunities for housing is we also took a look at the commercial and mixed use zones. You know, it could be because there are these constraints in the high density zones, both, you know, in terms of how much high density land there is and what's permitted there. But we certainly heard anecdotally that there was interest in having residential development options in the commercial and mixed use areas. And we're trying to get a better sense of, well, why is that, you know, when technically the VBLM tells us we have enough residential land without touching the commercial land supply. So trying to understand that, but also trying to understand where the residential options opportunities could be. So right now in these zones, there's options for vertical mixed use, which is similar to this picture here on the right, where you can have residential units above ground floor retail, commercial office space. But there could be some opportunities. There's a lot of reasons why that isn't always a preferred development type, and might not always come to market. And so there could be some opportunity to create a mix of uses using some different strategies. So first of all, on an individual site, you could allow more of a horizontal mixed use configuration, where you have commercial on one portion of the property, all residential on a different portion. You could also look at, you know, within, say, a commercial corridor, are there strategic rezones to residential so that that mix of uses is created along the corridor and not necessarily on an individual site. And then there's also ways to look at allowing residential outright. And that could be, you know, maybe for all types. I've also seen opportunities to, you know, for example, exempt regulated affordable housing projects from that ground floor residential. So there's some different ways that we could structure that if there is interest in expanding housing options in these zones. So go ahead. That brings us just about to the end. So the last thoughts that I just offer on zoning and what we found in our audit in terms of regulations, is that there really is a range of housing options in the current codes and plans that create a variety of opportunities. And some have really been, you know, we've seen built out a lot more on the ground. So there could, you know, the exploratory side really was looking at some additional opportunities for change, particularly adding middle housing options and possibly expanding the higher density choices and limiting development eliminating obstacles to their development. So that's what I've got. And then I'll pause for some questions before Steve jumps into the last part of this presentation.
Elizabeth, maybe before we move on to my section at the end, I was wondering if Commissioner Barca has any reflections from, as our representative on the project advisory group, if he has any observations he might like to share from the conversations we've had in those meetings thus far.
All right, thank you, Steve. I think looking at the work that was done by the consultants, we can see the consistent trend since 2011 in the concept of housing prices versus available wages. I recognize the fact that the entire region seems to be land constrained right now, but I believe that we can also see that the constraint is in the context of building housing for customers above the 120% AMI. And the discussion about how we are treating the rest of the citizenry below that is a much more nuanced and complex discussion. If we say that this 10-year trend has been going on, I would say that our zoning science in Clark County has not really deviated significantly since 2005, 2007, somewhere in that range. So I think it's very important for the Planning Commission to kind of recognize what strategies, what policies do we believe are worth our discussion in bringing forward as this advisory body to both Oliver's team and the county council based on the data that we're seeing. You know, I think as long as we just watch this information continue to grow, we're not going to achieve any kind of goals that we say in the comprehensive plan we expect to meet. And I think that there's a lot of goals that Jackie can bring forward and remind us of that will be stuff that's already written in our comprehensive plan that we are supposed to be addressing. And I don't think the idea of speedier permits or opening up additional land for houses in the $500,000 range is really going to be the tool, the one tool. I think what we really want to do here in the Planning Commission is start talking about what's our short-term goals, what's our long-term goals, where do we see deficiencies. And I think this information is really important. I believe once this housing option group gets together and starts looking at recommendations, I think they're going to want to focus on a few things that they think are really within the purview of the group to ask for from the council. There'll be one or two really big asks. I think in the Planning Commission, we have the opportunity to take this same information and really go after it a little bit deeper, a little bit wider, and say, where are we hitting the mark and where are we missing the mark? We have to be able to measure how well we're doing in some of these things. So, all right, Steve, thanks for the opportunity to speak. And I'm hoping to hear from some of the other planning commissioners when we wrap up tonight.
You bet. Thank you, Commissioner Barca. And at our next meeting, we're going to begin, to your point, we're going to try to hone in on, like you said, what our focus areas might be, where we can be most effective, and start with a large list of potential strategies that over the coming months, we're going to try to hone down. Could we go back to that project schedule slide, please? The one above this one. So as Jackie mentioned, yeah, right there, we're in, we're wrapping up phase two basically, and starting phase three where we develop the recommendations. And part of that, I just wanted to mention, is additional briefings with you all, with County Council, as well as some public engagement activities. Let's go to the next slide. The public engagement plan that Jackie and Jenna prepared lists a number of potential activities to engage the public. Obviously, some of these are still hindered by COVID requirements, but things, you know, including workshops and open houses, questionnaires. We've done a lot of phone interviews already. We could do some online types of websites and storytelling, printed materials, just a whole range of activities. And I want to encourage all of you, not only to, if you have, as Commissioner Barca said, if you have ideas about strategies we should be looking at, but also if you have ideas about activities that you think would be particularly effective in engaging or educating the broader public, we're welcome to those ideas as well. Let's go to the next slide. Oh, I just wanted to mention, we didn't add it to this presentation, but we are planning a virtual public meeting, kind of a kickoff meeting, where we will present this same information that we presented to you, to the broader public, and engage with them in a conversation about, you know, what they think it means, and potentially brainstorming ideas for strategies to address some of these issues at that time as well. So I don't know if we have a time yet, but we're looking at May 11th for that virtual public meeting. And we can take questions, but I just would ask Jackie if she has anything to add. Nope.
Nope, I'm good. I'm interested to hear any questions or feedback for us.
Steve, this is Matt Swindell. And first off, you guys, ton of information here. And I appreciate all the hard work that you guys put into this. I know how hard it is to go out and gather that information. So thank you for everything you guys have done. I'm kind of a get down to brass tacks, very, very simplistic person in the way I look at things. And back up in some of the other slides there, we were talking about income and what people were making and 120% and all that jazz. And I'd really like to just ask a very basic question. Based on the income that we see in the county, how many low-income housing units do we need to provide in the future? You know what I mean? In the next 20-year plan. Like, we should have a number based on the growth, based on what the average income is. How many units do we need? Do we know that?
Yeah. And if we could go back, there was a slide that shows the number of units that we need at different types. I think it's somewhere around slide 16. It's a blue bar chart with the bars pointing vertically.
And it was in there. I'm sorry, I didn't.
That's okay.
Catch it,
there it was. So there it is, right there. Nice.
Trying to figure out how many total units in that low income housing do we need for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think one of the things that we're doing right now that we have most of the information, data collection and analysis done, what we want to do is look at this chart and say, okay, where can some of the work that we're doing be most effective? Now we see that there's more than 6,000 units needed for the 120% AMI range. But I think that those units are, you know, typically single family detached homes, and those are being provided by the market. Okay. So we want to look below that number. I don't want to jump ahead because we haven't qualified this exactly yet, but I don't know that the types of solutions we're talking about are going to solve problems at the bottom end of that spectrum. That
I'm not necessarily looking at how, you know, solving the problem. I'm just looking at that overall number. Hey,
right,
6,000. It's, you know, it's 20,000. Whatever that number is kind of a number in my head. I'm trying to get to. So when we are sitting as a planning commission and we're talking about changing zoning on this one to meet this, and changing zoning to change it to that, we can really draw back to that number and go, is it taking away or is it adding to? Because that's something that Ron and I talked a lot is, hey, if we keep nickel and diamond and taking away and eating away at all of our land for either commercial or for low income or residential, we really have to make sure we're keeping an eye on the buckets here. And I really want to have that, just that very simple number.
Yeah. You know,
we need this many units is what I'm looking for. And then with that, I know you probably can't answer that tonight. And that's totally
fine. I can give you just a little bit here. So if we look at, for instance, 80 to 120% AMI, that's about 3,000 units. I would say preliminarily, we're looking at least 3,000. And again, we haven't finalized this. I haven't talked to Jackie and Jenna or our advisory group. So I don't know if we're going to include, you know, 50 to 80%, which is another 2,000. So,
okay,
you know, 3 to 5,000. I don't know, Jackie, is that off base? Does that seem aligned with what we're looking at through this project?
I think so. We know that, like, Washington State guidance on this, you know, they've got some information about the types of housing that usually typically falls within those income brackets. And 50% and under are typically could be subsidized housing and types like that, whereas 50 to 80 apartments, accessory dwelling units, manufactured, 80 to 120 duplexes, triplexes, townhomes. So we have that kind of information to help kind of figure out what we may need for those income brackets that we'll start working with the advisory group on.
Okay, that really helps. Now I've got another question. And this kind of goes back to my land acquisition days, and we always ran our numbers backwards. You don't start with how much you're paying for the land and then figure out what you're going to sell your house for. You look at your market and you say, okay, what can I sell my house for in this market? And you work your numbers backwards and you get to the land and you say, that's what I can pay for that land. I'm kind of looking at that in this, looking at this way, is that what do we consider affordable in those ranges? What's that dollar amount that they can afford to pay? Are we talking about rent? Are we talking about paying for rent or buying a home? A couple different things there. What's that overall number that we're saying is affordable? Is it a $250,000 house? Is it a $1,500 a month rent payment? And I really want to look at those numbers and understand what that is. So then we can, when we're talking to developers, when we're talking about land, we're talking about UGA, we can really look at that and work our numbers backwards. Because I think changing zoning, doing all this is great, but really, does it work? Does it get us to where we're trying to go? And that's really a very simple way for me to look at it. I don't know about the rest of the Planning Commission, but I like to look at it and go, okay, what's affordable? What does that end? And then look at our development community and say, okay, here's what's affordable. How do we get there? And work with them in that way.
Does that make sense? Thank you for that comment. Actually, in our longer presentation to the PAG, there was a slide, and there's a graphic in the report. It's kind of in the shape of a house, and it shows what affordable housing prices and rents are at these different income brackets. Okay. You can kind of look at it along with this one. So that information is in the report. And in addition, Eco Northwest is working on a pro forma to look at a couple variables and how they might potentially make certain housing types more affordable. And that pro forma is limited in scope, but it gives us a little bit more information that will be presented at the next PAG Project Advisory Group meeting.
Okay, that's great, because I think if we can look at that overall number and go, okay, here's the dollar, and then how much is materials costing? Well, they just tripled this last year. You know, what's labor? And you start, you're working your numbers back down, and then you look at your land and you say, oh, wow, okay, here's where we're at. Here's reality. It's kind of a reality check in that no matter what we do, it may come to a conclusion of no matter what we do, no matter how much we try to do this, we're only going to get to here when we need to get to there. And I really want to see that really simplistic reality check. Can we get there?
Thank you.
This is Aldo. I want to add to what Matt was saying, and I see things. I'm a very visual person, and I imagine myself being in the markets with a certain income level, trying to map what I make and where I want to live to have a great living experience in Clark County. And Matt, you're going right for the numbers to get it to be as tangible as possible. I'm coming from the other side of trying to imagine what some of these prototypes might look like. Number one, would they even appeal to me given our current market conditions? I'm just, really shocked at the income increase in comparison to the increase in real estate and housing. Is just like that gap will just get wider and wider over the years. So we'll always be struggling with that. So in some sense, we kind of all own this situation to bring about a workable solution. And the other aspect that I think about is what does this, when I was reading through all the backup material around the city of Spokane and what they were struggling with under a little bit different conditions, but they did an excellent job of marketing, getting the message out, not necessarily getting into the hardcore numbers and zoning, but increasing the market appeal. I looked at their website, the city of Spokane, really expresses some very technical information in terms that makes it easy for people to digest and figure out where they are in terms of the kind of house I want, or even for developers, the kind of houses or the structures that I want to build for certain kinds of incomes. So I think what's key going forward, and this may be part of your next steps, is to have actual tangible models that represent what is doable in the county that a developer or a potential homeowner could, you know, touch and feel and explore more than just numbers on a page. And to have a strong marketing message around that, so that it has a high level of appeal in order to help sell this to folks who are in these particular situations. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you.
Anybody else?
Yeah, Brian Halbert here. And again, I think like Matt, like to express the amount of information is really overwhelming and a lot to absorb in a presentation, but amazing and great job. A concern like all those even saying the income to affordability ratio is, I would say, widening because of the price increases, the tripling of materials, and how are there any methods that we can look at in your recommendations, or will you be looking at to help offset that cost for the whether it's the first-time home buyer or anybody below that 80% or 50% affordability? Just a concern there, and how we can address that. The slide said that we are 13,000 units short of homes over the next 10 years, I believe, if I got that right. Is that even possible in Clark County to catch up? Or what, and I think that's what some of your recommendations are probably going to point out, is how can we get to that place where we see the demand and the housing starting to intersect, or the available housing starting to intersect? I like what you had to say about the 2 to 4-plex or the smaller units being separated out in the code from the larger units. It would make a person who has that extra property available, would make it easier for them to maybe look at that property being better utilized with duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, and not be as constrained as they would be if they were building a 100-unit apartment, or, you know, streamlining that process. It really could help that that gentleman builder who's got the property, has been in his family a long time, not big enough for a developer to come in, but make it easier path for a person to turn it into a developable place. The other question I have is really, how did we get to where we're at? It seems like pre-recession up to 2008, we weren't having these conversations. People were able to buy homes. Is it that since the recession's ended, has the income reduced, or the price of homes increased so much that we have this unaffordability factor? Has there been any look at that? Not that we need to know that, but I think more out of curiosity, how do we get to where we're at, or the causes of that?
Yeah, the best person to respond to that would have been our economist, but Elizabeth or Jackie, do you have any thoughts about that question?
Hi.
Elizabeth, go ahead.
Sure, I mean, I can tell you what What we hear anecdotally is all the easy land has already been developed, right? Which now that's something people said 10 years ago, right? There's something people said 30 years ago, and they're going to say it 10 years from now too. But, you know, I don't know if this is entirely true, but just also like based on my experience, you know, working in the county, it did seem like there were more larger properties that were able to, you know, bring forward a larger number of single family detached units, and maybe they were at prices that better met average wages at the time. But, you know, I think maybe it wasn't headline news, you know, before the recession, but I'm gonna guess this problem has been a long time in the making. And, you know, if we see the chasm right now as being, it doesn't even fit on here, but, you know, this wide, well, at one point it was this wide and we just, you know, you couldn't quite see it. So probably has been a problem for a while.
So, and I wonder if part of wage increases or helping keep more jobs in Clark County would help solve this problem. If somebody's spending 45 minutes a day in their car, that certainly takes away from their ability to afford a higher priced home or a home with an increased price, whether renting or buying, because they're doing so much traveling. If that could be part of the focus.
And it means they have higher household transportation expenses.
Correct.
Well, one thing to keep in mind is the interest rates of 2008 were about 6%. Now they're 4% or below. So the buying power that someone has today is actually about $50,000 more than in 2008. For that $300,000 home they were buying in 2008, they can buy that same home at $350,000 today at about the same price, you know, same payment per month. So I don't know. Have you guys taken any of that into consideration with your affordability matrix?
That is a question I'm going to have to loop back to our Eco Northwest folks with and get back to you all with an answer on how that was factored into the analysis.
This would be just a side question just to see how that played out. So.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Brian here again, reading an interview notes, the developer saying that it's a $350,000 a unit just to bring them to market today. And like Matt said, if you start at that 350, work backwards, the price of the land makes it pretty difficult to meet the affordability factors that we have. So
the only thing you can do is do higher densities and go up taller.
Yeah,
units per acre. That's really the only way you can do it, because unless you can go out and create more land somewhere,
right?
Land prices aren't going down.
And that maybe that is some of the answer for Clark County. And I do see more multi-story apartments going up around the county. Brings up one other question. Is that condos, it seems like it was like the lowest percentage of ownership or properties in Clark County. Is there a reason that Clark County has such a low condo population when it could?
Condos, it's all about risk, Brian. It's developer's risk. Nobody wants to build it because of the liability. Too many people are getting together and suing the heck out of the developers. I wouldn't touch a condo. I won't even do maintenance on a condo just because of the liability. So
yet it could help add to the affordability of homes.
They'll help change the laws.
Yes, that would.
Developers can't get sued.
Matt, Brian and Matt, both of you are correct. This is Oliver. The condo issues is just about regulations and potential risk. So unless the legislature can amend some of the risk, it is very difficult to build and manage and deal with all the risk.
Mm-hmm. So this is Ron. So I think this is a great discussion for us in the context of saying, you know, what can we actually leverage and what can we do? There was a slide earlier that showed, you know, over the last 10 years, how wages went up 12% and housing costs went up 95%. We can't expect the builders to abandon the opportunity for their best margin, and their best margins are happening at a higher priced house, just as was already talked about by Matt and yourself, the idea that if land costs are what they are, and you spend $350,000 to put a house on, you're going to be up in a range that is taking you there. And this is a good graphic right here, the 120% or greater AMI. So if we think about it in terms of 88,000 is just 100% of AMI, and all of the people that are falling below that, we have to consider the idea of where are we really going to be able to leverage. Our number that we talk about, this 13,000 units, is based on what the county believed that they could afford for capital facilities and the number of total units built out over the 20-year comprehensive plan. That's how I believe this number was generated. We can't open up vast tracts of land if the county can't afford to service the people in them. We can't put the facilities in a timely fashion or tax our way out of that kind of problem. So I think in us looking at it is we also have to consider the idea that in supply and demand, this is a metro region collector. And if we came up with a whole bunch of really great affordable housing that was targeted at that 100% AMI without doing anything different in the way we develop them, if we just created more single family dwellings, you would have the Tri-County area on the south side of the river marching over here to get a great deal on a house. And we would still have the same number of people at the low end unable to fulfill the desire of appropriate housing. So I think we need to be clever enough that when we look at this, that the things that we're going to be doing are going to have some positive leverages and keep the county still solvent while doing it, right?
Ron, yeah, thanks. That's yes. You really framed well there. There isn't just one solution, is there? And if we have more affordable housing, more people will come in, whether it's from Portland or other parts of the country. We want growth, but managed growth.
So, Ron, are you suggesting that we increase fees for people who live outside the county to move in here? to thwart that a little bit? Are you wanting to give incentives to sell to people that live within our county borders?
No, Matt. I think what we're talking about here is utilizing the existing land base and coming up with solutions that allow developers some opportunity, but we're not going to be pulling levers that are so large that we're throwing open, you know, 1,000-acre tracts of land. I guess that's what I'm really trying to get at. Your discussion about the idea of multi-level high density, I think we need to have really good discussions about that. There was the one pictorial that showed about the idea of the 1.5 cars per unit in the parking lot and how much space that took up. I think that's part of the kind of rational discussion we want to say. If dirt is the most important part, how are we using that dirt?
I would agree with you.
All right. Well, I think this has been a good discussion for us on this topic to start, you know, thinking about it and spinning our minds towards other opportunities. I think one of the things that we can look at when we get the vacant buildable lands analysis is parcels of land that are called underutilized or are prone to not develop, and try and figure out if there are levers that we ourselves have that could help developers shift some of that property. So those are kinds of things that I'm hoping that we'll get to. And for the people that haven't had a chance to go on the web and look at the housing option reports in full, this was just a slice of what the deck has been for, you know, the presentations. There's much, much more information, although it was talking about some of it as well. I'm going to encourage all my planning commissioners to take some time and to look at all of the material that is available. I think it's really important for us.
Will do.
Okay, thanks, Vaughn. Brian, did you have anything to say?
No, I think you guys captured most of my thought. You know, it was interesting to note the amount of opportunity, but it will come at making some people unhappy. So that was, you know, kind of interesting to see to see that. And I'm with Matt. I'm a numbers person, and you know, you start at one place and you work yourself back, and we identify where there are opportunities in terms of the county to influence those numbers. And I totally get what Ron is saying is, you know, the developers and builders are in the business of, you know, making money, or otherwise they wouldn't be in that business. So we got to figure out how to incentivize them to bring them to the table. But this is a very complex and difficult discussion that needs to happen. As someone pointed out, the chasm keeps getting larger. And so we can't just act and put our heads in the proverbial sand and act like it, you know, it's not here. So, yeah. So I appreciate most of the comments that's been made, and I agree with all of them. Very good.
Thank you, Brian. Yeah, just a quick add. Brian just kind of touched on it a little bit regarding going forward, and the. I didn't check the fact on the 500% increase of lumber. So we might just be seeing that. I don't want to say our data is not up to speed, but the chasm, I like the chasm analogy, that it could already be much wider than we're seeing. So we've got to get a handle on a lot of things. We can't take the whole apple at once. Tried to do that with all four, and we got to take little bites at a time. But I think we our ways to come into this in a proactive way as best we can. But I'm sure seeing some weird things with just the costs of building things, not to mention profit margins, which I agree. Builders are in the business to make money, but some of this stuff is ridiculous in the price, the absolute hard price. So Brian Halbert, that was an interesting point you made. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your, that was a great lot. It's dense. And so I think Ron's right. Make sure we get in there and dig. I dug a little bit into it, and I can do more. But I fear we're going to, not fear, but I would encourage us to do a little bit of extra reading on this, because we're going to be the ones that are going to be seeing this stuff probably first. So with that said, any questions? Ron, you got anything?
I got a comment here. As part of the housing options action group, I am putting together tours of Wolf Industries, who makes tiny homes. I have spoken with Jackie. She's talked with Oliver, and I'm going to be doing it outside of the county. And I have some tentative dates right now, the 28th, 29th, or 30th of this month. I'm looking at if anybody is interested. It's either going to be like a 10 to 11 tour, or it's going to be like a 1 to 2 o'clock tour. So send me a request to get on the list if you are interested in going out to Wolf Industries and to see them building tiny homes. These tiny homes are going to be placed in the Fruit Valley area. They're part of the Roots Collaborative project. And Vancouver Housing Authority is also having some homes built out there. And then the other thing is I'm trying to put together a tour of a multifamily development that's in the city of Vancouver off of Fourth Plain. It's called the Elwood. And it is a project that was made for some subsidized housing mixed with regular housing. And the subsidized housing is targeting developmentally disabled. It's a brand new building. It was put up by Vancouver Housing Authority. And then I think it's been leased to somebody else. I'm not positive on that. I don't have a date for that one, but if you're interested in visiting that, it's basically latest state of the art. And they put it on a really tough lot right along Fourth Plain, working with the city of Vancouver. So that gives us some ideas about what can be done in the context of development. I'd be happy to have Planning Commission come out and see both of those items. Just let me know.
Ron, I'll let you know right now. You can include me on both of those. I'd like to do that.
Same here, Ron. Oh, this is Aldo. Add me.
Ron, sign me up too, please.
Okay. Got it.
That constitute a public meeting for four of us together?
You know, it probably does. And what we'll have to do.
It's only three, right, Ron?
Well, if I'm at the meeting too, and Matt, Aldo, and Bryant show up, that would be four.
Oh, Bryant was on there too. Yeah, we just,
So I might try and split us up between two different tours. Okay. That would take care of it.
Okay, this is your attorney speaking.
Did I hear Christine say something?
You did. Can you all hear?
Barely.
Can you speak up, Chris?
No, I can't speak up. I'm hollering. Can you hear better now?
Yeah. I'll put my ear close.
Go ahead. You're good. Go ahead, Christine.
Okay, thanks. So, yeah, if you've got a quorum and you're talking about county business, that's subject to the Open Public Meetings Act. So, yeah, you could move that up, Sonia, if that works. So that would not be advisable.
What about splitting it up, Christine? So we're two.
There is a concept of a serial public meeting.
All right, I understand that.
But if you are not posing the same questions, having the precise, you know, having the same conversations and coming to an end result, then I suspect that the risk of that being construed as an open public meeting is much lower.
So Ron, do you want to make sure that that's organized in a way that's within what Christine just advised us?
Yeah, so for Matt, Aldo, and Bryant, I will make sure that when I send out the invitation, I put a disclaimer about what should not be discussed during the visit. And we will all have the same experience, but not talk about it in the terms of any kind of policy or legislative type activity.
Thank you. I think that is key right there.
Thank you. Okay, is there anything else for the good of the order? All right. Thank you. Great presentation. It's the second one. We've had a lot of good information. So, Sonia, do we have our next meeting on schedule? Just
Planning Commission members, can I just under your order, for the good of order, I just want to give you a very quick update on where we are with the vacant buildable lands model work. We had a discussion with council yesterday, and they directed that there be some runs done, maybe three options, which Bob Poole will be running. And we will present that to council, and council will review that before they decide whether to go to a hearing or not. And if it becomes part of, I'm sure it's going to become part of public information, we will at some point share that information with the Planning Commission. But we are not at a point where we will go to a hearing on the recommendations of the project advisory group. Just I thought I'd share that with you. So bear with us when we get to a point of hearing and sharing additional information with Planning Commission, we will. Maybe at a work session, come back to you and share with you where we are. So with that, thank you, Planning Commission members, unless you have a question for me.
Thank you. Any questions for Oliver? I've tried to look at all my screens. Okay. Sonia,
I don't understand what you're saying.
Our next meeting.
Oh, right now, we're going to be, the staff is going to be having a meeting next week on the upcoming Planning Commission docket. There's lots of items, but right now things are tentative on there. If there's anything for the month of May, I'll be letting you know as soon as possible. At this moment, we do not have any items on the May agenda. But if it changes in the next week or so, I'll be letting you know. I'll also be sending you out a docket just as an FYI to show you what is coming down the pike.
Thank you. Okay, well, hopefully someday we get to see each other in person. Gentlemen, ladies, that would be nice. So until then, have a great day. Have a great week.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night, everyone. Good night.
Good night.